All three Beards Media podcasts originate from the Gravitate Co-working Studio, sponsored by Revelton Distilling Company.
We are back live from the Gravity co-working studios with False Starts, Bill Blank, Chris Shipley. Bill, I think we're going to make it a full year on this podcast. January, I think.
Seriously? I didn't even think
I know. I was thinking about that today. I was like, you know, I think we started this in January. And I remember in February, I was sitting in that crappy hotel in Winona, Minnesota. So,
oh, yeah.
And I think we were three or four episodes in by then. So I think it was January.
Wow.
That's your weird. Longest running gig, ain't it?
Yeah. Steady anyway.
Unfortunately, the pay is shit. So.
Right. Well, I got a nice Three Beards Rocks glass.
You did.
Out of the deal.
And a pullover.
Hey, oh yeah, the pullover too, which is really nice, by the way.
Thank you.
Did I meet the third beard? Who's the third beard?
No. So, yeah, I don't think you've met either one.
I thought Tim was one of the beards.
Tim. Oh, yeah. But yeah, you were on the pod with Tim. Yeah. The other one is Aaron. Aaron's in Washington.
Okay.
And he was going to come this weekend. And he then 3 weeks ago, he's like, hey, I can't make that because I forgot it's my daughter's birthday that day.
Oh.
So he forgot that it was his daughter's birthday. But we're going to have a Christmas party at Teddy Holly's Polk City Pub next month for everybody. Nice. And Aaron will be there. So.
That's
and
cool.
Tim had car trouble. His transmission went out of his Subaru.
Right on.
So that's what happens when you.
That was a cool event, though. I had fun, and it was a better turnout than I thought. I thought, you know, going out to Osceola would be kind of a tall task for a lot of people, but a lot of people showed up. That was pretty
cool.
Yeah,
we had a nice crowd. Rob and Christy were ecstatic. We raised almost $1,200 for the Young Women's Resource Center. And, it was fun. It was a good time. So I was pretty proud of it. So,
I had a weird thing last week. I ended up canceling. I canceled a therapy session last week. Have you had to do that yet? Have you done that yet?
Cancel what?
A therapy session.
Yeah, I've actually canceled two of them. And let me tell you, yesterday afternoon, I could have used one. So,
yeah. So like that's. You know, that is something that we should probably touch on a little bit, like, since we're both steadily in therapy, like, it is okay every once in a while. Like,
right.
I didn't cancel it because I wasn't feeling it. It wasn't anything like that. I just, I got caught in between a couple of things, and I just kind of I could have squeezed it in, but I kind of needed the time. I didn't want to be pressed for time, and I don't know. It kind of doesn't do you any good if you're in a hurry.
It was kind of the same thing for me. I think the first time I had to cancel, I was supposed to pick the boys up at 3:00, and then they were just going to ride over to the place because they go to their therapist at the same place, so they're familiar with the complex and stuff. And they were just going to wait in the waiting room, and then they didn't show up till like 3:20, and my appointment was at 3:30, and I wasn't going to make it. And then the last one, I can't remember. Oh, I didn't get my car back in time.
Gotcha.
My car was in for some brakes or whatever, and I didn't get it back in time. So,
no crippling anxiety attacks over the deal. Everything.
No, but let me tell you, man. Yesterday I got some news professionally, and I was pretty bummed. And I needed some consoling. It was so bad that Stacy brought me flowers at the end of the day.
Oh my god!
To make me feel better. So.
Did they make you feel better or just demasculate the shit?
No,
emasculate
no,
the shit out of you?
Yeah, you know what? It was the thought that count. And she bought red and yellow flowers for Cyclones, so she knows me.
Oh.
So
she got you ugly ones on top of it. That's terrible.
All right.
Yeah. So we should bring our guest on here soon. I know this
should.
Is a busy
yep.
man, and I'm pretty excited to have him. It's a friend of mine. I met... I met Steve back in, I want to say 2003, 2004 in line auditioning for Last Comic Standing in Nashville. And we've been friends ever since. We've done some shows together, you know, ran into each other over the years, slept on each other's couches. It's been fun to watch the meteoric rise of my friend Steve Hofstetter. So welcome. Welcome, Steve, to False Starts.
Thank you much, Bill. It's good to see you. I was actually just a couple weeks ago, I was playing Zanies.
And, oh, really?
Yeah. And every time I do, there's like a little smile of like, oh, yeah, on this sidewalk right in front of this club is where hundreds of comedians were lied to and taken advantage of by a terrible television show.
Okay, so you should probably expand on that, because.
My full last comic story is, this was season two of Last Comic Standing, and I had sent a tape to the producers. You know, I didn't have any representation at the time. And so I sent a tape to the producers, and by the way, this is how long ago it was, a physical tape, VHS tape.
And you had to have the right amount of minutes on it or you weren't professional.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and you had to make sure you didn't like tape over a show or something like that. You know, you had to a professional seeming tape. And so I sent a tape and they got back to me and they were like, hey, we want you to come audition in Nashville. And I was like, oh, I appreciate that, but I actually am going to be in LA during the LA auditions. And they were like, well, the producers said we want you to audition in Nashville. And I was like, so they liked me enough to look up my schedule, see that I would be within 4 hours in Nashville, that I could make it, but not enough to just give me an audition in LA. And she just goes, I'm a PA. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. Like, she was not a decision maker whatsoever. She was just passing the news on. And so they said that there were no, you couldn't skip the line in Nashville.
No call times,
Yeah, in LA and New York, there were people who were like, you know, you didn't have to wait in line. And they were like, yeah, we're not doing that in Nashville, but we want you to audition there. I was like, okay, great. No problem. And I was a kid. I didn't know any better. We waited on that sidewalk in the rain and the snow overnight. And
10 plus hours.
Yep. And then find out that through no fault of their own. I think it was John Heffron.
Heffron won it that year. We watched Heffron get out of a cab because you and I were in the front of the line.
Yep.
And we watched them all get out of cabs and walk in.
Yep. It was Heffron. I think, maybe Kreischer, he was somewhere else. I forget what, but there were three people who made it from Nashville were not in the line with the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And that's not their fault. It's the producers lying to us and telling them that they had prearranged times. It was such a miserable experience. I wanted to quit comedy that day. It didn't help that that neighborhood used to be much worse. My car got broken into.
Yeah. I remember
that. Yeah. But it was awful, and I wanted to quit, and then I didn't come to the showcase. I refused. My buddy who I was auditioning with, Josh Jacobs, he went to the showcase, and I was like, I'm staying in the stupid, you know, $30 flea bag motel that we got. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I kind of deliriously had this realization that, like, I don't hate stand up. I hate TV. Like, TV is what did this. Stand up is, you know, was still pure. And so it kind of set my path in motion of saying, fuck the industry. And I've been saying that ever since.
Yeah. I mean, Steve, you know, we've obviously you've come out recently and been more open about your struggles with anxiety and everything over the years. Mm-hmm. I guess first of all, you know, what made you decide to be open about it? How have you always been open? Have you gone to therapy? What's kind of your story mental health wise?
So for a long time, I didn't go to therapy. And it was mainly because, like, I wasn't ever in one place long enough. Mm-hmm. You know, what am I going to do? Like book a therapist and just be like, all right, I got one Tuesday in October. I'm on the road till mid-December, but then the holidays. So maybe I'll see you around President's Day. Does that work for you? So I never did it. And then when I was in LA and, you know, I kind of became like a regular at the Laugh Factory, that became a home club. And they had this program at the time. I don't know if they still do, but they had this program where they had an in-house therapist that was free for six sessions to any comedian on the roster who wanted to use the program. And, you know, this came out of Jamie Masada having lost a lot of friends to mental health. You know, everyone from Robin Williams to Richard Jenny. I mean, we have a tendency of dying young. And so I, you know, decided, hey, let me try this out. And I went to therapy and it was pointless because the therapist that I had at the time was had so many clients that I don't think it was necessarily her fault, but I felt like I had to start over every session. Mm. And how do you make how does she have insight into who you really are if she doesn't even remember what you said? And so that didn't really work. And then, you know, I kind of abandoned it for a while. And I had, you know, over the years, I came to terms with, all right, we'll get real personal on this. I came to terms with having an eating disorder. And at the time, I did not know that that was a form of anxiety. You know, when I first came to terms with it, you know, so little is said about men with eating disorders. It's, you know, I mean, for every very special episode of television that they've ever made, I don't think they've ever done that storyline.
No, I've always said it's a rich white girl disease.
Yeah, that's what people think. And it is absolutely not. In fact, the medical industry is so behind on it that the term for my eating disorder is EDNIS, which is short for eating disorder not otherwise specified. They just basically, they're like a bulimia, anorexia, binge, and then a trash bag of stuff. And so I'm in the trash bag of stuff, and it just took a lot of introspection, a lot of, you know, kind of research in until finally putting it together that it was anxiety. And I think, you know, the pandemic sped that up for me. It was there was really a moment where it all kind of came to pass where like my career blew up digitally over the pandemic. And, you know, I went from having, you know, 100,000 followers on Facebook, which I thought was pretty good, to having 700,000. It was, you know, I went from being able to sell 50 tickets to a bar to being able to play theaters. And I didn't really know how to deal with that once I got back out on the road. It was not only was I finally out of my house for the first time in a year, but also I was interacting with more people than I ever had before. And it was starting to mess with me. And I was doing a show at the Gramercy in New York, which I was so excited about. I'm from Queens. I went to high school and college in Manhattan. This was a home show. This was like, I get to play a theater I used to walk by. And I get there and I'm so excited. My name's on the marquee and it's like this amazing thing. And we dealt with a lot of people being new to their jobs after the pandemic. And this guy, you know, I go to walk in. And this guy is like, oh, we're not open yet. And I go, oh, no, you know, it's fine. I'm Steve. And then he like proceeds to still not want to let me in. And then he like pats me down. And basically, this is a guy overdoing his job. He's being an idiot. His job should be right this way, Mr. Hofstadter.
Right.
But
right. Yeah.
He's just being an idiot. It's fine. But I felt this like anger inside. I wanted to yell at this guy, and that's not me at all. And like, I kind of, after that day, I had a few days off and I was just sitting there being like, what the hell is happening to me? And that was the incident that, you know, kind of spurred it on. But there were a couple other things where I had this like rage inside of me that I'd never felt before. And I knew something was wrong. And so I started just kind of exploring it more and, you know, came to terms with the fact that it's, you know, the eating disorder is anxiety based. And then I started seeing a therapist and getting meds and all that stuff. So yeah, long story long, that's how it happened.
So
go ahead.
Okay. do you think that in that moment, that rage that you felt, do you think that do you think that rage was anxiety based, or do you?
Yeah. It was being pulled in a lot of different directions at once, and it did not have anything to do with what that guy said or did.
It was overwhelmed mostly.
It was being completely overwhelmed. It was, you know, I went from someone who like occasionally took pictures with people after shows, and mostly as they're saying, "Hey, if you ever get famous."
Which is
such a nice thing to be like, "Hey, I don't really want this picture now. I'm just investing in the what could be."
Sure.
but it went from that to like literally we had a show in Baltimore where I had this like mini school bus I was touring in, and this woman put her head in, like I was loading the back of the bus, and this woman comes over after an already awkward interaction with me on the merch line where she's like throwing herself at me and I'm like, this is not okay. And she sticks her head in the bus, like in the main part of the bus. And bear in mind, at this point, it's like four sweaty guys touring together.
Yeah.
And she sticks her head in the bus and just goes like that. And I'm just like, what the fuck is this? And it was stuff like that where I was just like, this is completely overwhelming and I do not know how to handle this. And the thing that my therapist said that really stuck with me is anxiety is the right response at the wrong time.
I like that. I haven't heard that before.
It's great. It's tough to hear that as a comic that we don't have good timing, but
yeah.
the idea that like everything was, it was almost like there's a decoder ring where you have to shift it to see what the correct response is. And so I was, you know, as someone who never gets angry, I found myself getting angry at things that shouldn't anger me. As, you know, someone who can usually let things roll off my back, I found, you know, I just wanted to curl up in a ball and not talk to anybody. And, you know, that kind of made me realize, okay, something's wrong. And then thus begins the exploration of finding out what the hell it is.
Yeah, I've basically got a version of that, I guess. Like, I find myself, and we've talked about this on this podcast several times. I get that way in a competitive environment. Like
you want to have the most anxiety?
Well, like, no, when I get that anger, like,
yeah.
If I'm losing, I want to fight. Like when I was in high school, if we were losing, I wanted to fight the other team. And it was rewarded. Like, my coaches loved it, right? And I'm still at 45 years old trying to shake that. Like, obviously, it doesn't manifest itself now in a competitive environment because I'm never in one. But it's more so, like, if I'm watching my favorite team play, I'm that idiot. And it's the only place where I'm like that. And I can't figure it out. I can't figure out how, like, do I just embrace it now? Am I too fucking old? Like,
do you have ESPTSD?
What is that?
Just post-traumatic stress disorder about sports, I think.
Oh yeah, he does.
Yeah,
He's got the scars on his face to prove it.
Yeah, that doesn't like, it didn't work that way for me, especially because like, I'm bigger now than I used to be, but for a very long time, I mean, you met me when I was a very slight person.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think my lowest was, I'm 6'4" and I was 132 at one point. Like, wow. I was a very, very emaciated person. Yeah. And so you don't look to start fights when you could lose a fight to the person breaking it up. For me, it was just a lot, you know, it was just a lot more like so the eating disorder is basically nausea. Yeah. It is when there's a lot of things that make the average person a little bit nauseous, mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, stress or worry or fear or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But for me, when I would feel that, I would want to throw up, and it would be like a compulsion to throw up. And that's really difficult. Because like when you're trying to throw up, you're trying to get rid of something. That's mm-hmm. what the body is doing. You're getting rid of the alcohol that's making you feel that way. You're getting rid of the food poisoning. But I was trying to get rid of me. And that's a lot tougher. So I just like for a long time, I didn't know what caused it. And then it, like, if you go back far enough, I used to fake being sick to get out of being bullied because I would go to the nurse's office in high school. Mm-hmm. And this was, you know, starting from when I was 13. And so basically I spent, you know, 4 years using a stomach ache as avoidance. And eventually my system was like, And I think that's kind of where it stems from.
That makes sense. So like any type of anxiety basically triggers the nausea, which then gives you, that's what then makes you like the mixed bag, because if you're nauseous before you eat, you don't eat. So that makes you anorexic. And then if you're nauseous after you eat, you throw up, which makes you bulimic.
Now I have, you know, I have a little bit of a belly because I'm getting healthier. Uh-huh. And that's, you know, that's the unfortunate side effect of good mental health. Right. I can eat again. But the problem is that sometimes I do get genuinely sick. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know what it is for a while. Mm-hmm. Like I have this because you never get over an eating disorder.
Right.
That stays with you your whole life. You just learn to beat it more often than it beats you. Mm-hmm. But when, you know, I had a really bad stomach flu last year and I just was like, oh no, it's happening again. I thought I had this under control. And then like by day two or three, you go, oh yeah, this is just illness. But that first night you don't know. And, you know, so it's very difficult to kind of sort what is real and what isn't.
Well, and then it compounds your anxiety. Now you're having anxiety about your anxiety.
Absolutely true. Right. And so it's something that there's like a lot of little, you know, tricks I've kind of learned over the years. And, you know, one of the tricks is, so my fiance has named my anxiety, she calls it Wade, because she just, she figured if we give it a name, that's a much better way of addressing it than just saying, oh, the anxiety, because then you start thinking and you start spiraling. And so it's a lot easier to, you know, just have a funny little name for it. And so that way, even saying it's happening makes you smile a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you just have
Wade bothering me again.
Exactly. Damn, yeah. Wade. I hate that guy. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, even like the meds that I take, you know, we refer to that as my Wadeison. And so like just having that little takes you out of the moment. Really.
Yeah. Helps. You know, that's the cutest way of dealing with anxiety I've ever heard.
Thank you. We're an adorable couple.
Yeah, it was. But see, that's the other thing, that with that competitiveness, like I started dealing with anxiety at a very young age, where I mean, like 18, 19 was when it got labeled to me, but I was going to therapy at like 12 and 13 for it. Just didn't know what it was.
Yeah.
But I got to where that's how I dealt with it. I dealt with it in a competitive way. I looked at it as an opponent. I was always like, and like you said, that nausea, well, that's where anxiety always started for me, in the gut. And I think that's how it is for most people. I think it starts in your gut, because I think it's kind of a caveman, like intuitiveness or something, like something that's just in our DNA.
Yeah.
And I do feel like maybe comics, more so, I think comics have a higher level of anxiety because we have a higher level of self-awareness, and it doesn't make sense to people how we can be on stage and not freak out, but then we freak out after the show.
Well, that's the one, you know, on the stage is the one place I can breathe.
Right.
Like that's because
you're in control. That's what they don't get. That's when we're in control.
Yep. On stage is the place that, you know, no one can harm us. You know, Chris Rock aside.
Right. Right.
But typically, that is where no one can harm us. And so it is where I feel the most comfortable. Mm-hmm. I think also comics tend to have anxiety because people with a lot of anxiety don't always fit in. Mm-hmm. And so we become introspective because of that. And then that leads to us becoming a comic. It's a bit of a chicken and egg, but also I've seen people on social media be like, oh, it's like everyone has anxiety now. How come there's so much more anxiety? It's like, well, first of all, because they used to just refer to us as weird. Like learning what we have is an important
thing. Or told you
to
shut up and toughen up and deal with it.
Exactly. Or in the 1600s, they were like, she's a witch. You know, like there were just things that they didn't understand. But also, people with anxiety survive. Anxiety is Darwinism, because when you are scared of something, you do not interact with that thing. And oftentimes, that's overly cautious. Mm-hmm. But also, it is regular cautious. Mm-hmm. And so I think, in a way, Darwinism creates more anxiety, if that makes sense.
That 100% makes sense. I mean, I think that, you know, I've always said that I believe anxiety, in a way, is my superpower. Like, I feel like you can repackage a lot of quote unquote mental illness, you know, when they use the word, you know, now we're stopping kind of using that word illness, which is a good thing. But, you know, a lot of it, rather than an illness to me, is a strength, because, and I've talked about it many times, the anxiety in these regular everyday situations where I just feel anxious and I feel weird, it makes it so that I'm so calm under pressure and I'm so like focused on solutions when there's something really big happening. Like I'm really good in a foxhole, you know?
I have not thought about connecting those two things before, but those are like the two most things in my personality. Like my friends on tour nicknamed me Clutch, because the idea was that like when my back is against the wall, that's when I do my best work.
Exactly. Time slows down for you. Like it just whoop.
Right. And I never thought about why before. And I think that might be why.
Yeah, I think 100% that's why. I mean, that dude, that just gave me goosebumps, that revelation you just gave. Swear to God it did.
Well, you just gave me that revelation. I mean, that's fantastic. But it is like, I think that, you know, might be true, because the idea of like, you know, why should I be scared that, you know, that I might lose my job? I'm scared crossing the street. I'm used to scared.
Yes.
Like this is okay.
Yes. And when everybody else is scared, we're not. Mm-hmm. Like it's just, it's that, it's the fight or flight thing. And there are, you know, there are people that go into flight mode, but I think us guys like us that like comics mostly and stuff we're in fight mode. It doesn't manifest itself necessarily as a physical fight, but we're running towards the danger rather than away from it when it comes to that situation.
Yeah, there was a moment that kind of I like to use as this is who I am as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was coming back from a gig and I'm in the middle of nowhere, you know, some small California town just passing through, and I stop to get something to eat, and I notice that there is a group of people just standing around looking at a Starbucks. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? And one of them motions up and one of the umbrellas had like blown up onto the roof. Now this umbrella, it's got like an 8-foot stake with a freaking spike at the end. If this thing comes down on someone in the wrong way, this is a very dangerous thing. But also it's an easy thing to solve. You get the umbrella down.
Yeah.
And they're all just looking at it. And I walk into the Starbucks and I go, hey, do you guys have like a ladder in the back? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, can I use it to take that umbrella down? And, you know, the baristas, they don't care about the liability. Their company.
No, so exactly.
So they hand me the ladder and I just get up and I take the umbrella down and I put it down and I give them the ladder and they go, you want a free drink or something? And I was like, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And they give me the free drink and I go, thanks. And I go and I get something to eat. And that's me in a couple of ways. One, in that I see a problem and immediately I want to solve it.
Yep.
And two, I am very happy to accept a reward for that.
Yeah.
So, right. Yeah.
That adds up.
Steve, we got to.
But also three, you're not one of the dumb fucks standing around looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, There's the third part of your personality that's going, Jesus, you dumb motherfuckers, get a ladder. You got a ladder.
Yeah, either get a ladder or leave.
Right, because you're not solving the problem, and I can't get in to get my coffee. So move your
ass. You're not solving the problem, and you might have a spike going through your heart in a second. Yeah. So. Exactly.
Steve, we got a question here. You're well known for your crowd work and handling of heckers. How do you channel anxiety to be good at that?
Well, that goes back to what Bill was saying before. It's a good question in that, like, it's something I know how to do. And it's something, it's not something I always knew how to do. You know, it is, it's, I've had a lot of practice. You know, I've been at this for 20 years, and I learned early that, if you're too mean too quickly, it doesn't work. And
told you, you Chris. Know, I told you, Chris.
What? Oh, wait, does Chris do that?
No, I was. I've told him that exact thing about heckers before. Yep. I'm like, you have to let them hang themselves. You
can't. 100%.
You go at them too early, you look like somebody that can't handle themselves.
Yes. You can't handle the pressure.
The audience has to hate them more than you do. It's that thing from Gladiator.
Yeah, they have to. Yeah, they have to be annoyed.
Then you don't even have to be clever. You don't have to be clever at that point. You can go shut up, you drunk cunt, and everybody cheers.
There was a woman once who was she was at a bachelorette party because for some reason clubs give discounts to people who want to run shows. And it's, by the way, my favorite thing about my career now is that I no longer have to play to bachelorette parties.
Yeah.
But the this woman would not shut up. And, you know, eventually I'm just going back and forth with her. And, you know, I find out she's the maid of honor. And I go, oh, yeah, so this is your day. This is absolutely your day. And I was like, great. And you're going to give a speech. Fantastic. I'm sure that's going to be short and to the point. And it's like, it's going okay, but she just keeps interrupting. And finally, and I've already at this point find out that, you know, she's like married with kids. And I go, you know, I wish you luck at the wedding this weekend. I hope you catch the bouquet. And she goes, I'm married. And I go, I know, but your husband is going to leave you and you'll probably die alone. So good luck. And the reason it was okay to say that is because the audience wanted so much worse for her.
Right.
By the time I said that, the audience was like, what a nice man that he only wished that for her.
Right.
It is, but to go back to the question, it's just, you know, it's knowing the game. It's having confidence in it. And it's also paying attention. You know, it goes back to what we were talking about being, you know, analytical and being introspective. And so when I have handled a heckler where I've gotten too angry, where I've gone in too quick, where, you know, where I've made those mistakes, I will fix that for the next time. I won't just have it happen again. I will learn from that mistake. And so I think that's a lot of it.
Great. Bill, Tim says you're known for being heckled. That's it. I'll take my comments.
I don't know who this Tim is, but I like the cut of his chin.
Tim is one of the beards. He was commenting on Twitter, but he's too dumb to realize that comments on Twitter don't show up. So he flipped to YouTube.
Nice. So
maybe if he actually did some work around here, he'd know that.
I'll take my comments off air. But yeah, I mean, it's basically like, how do you channel the anxiety? Well, it kind of goes back to the original thing. The stage is where we're in control. There's no anxiety up there because we're in control. And Steve laid it out perfectly. You know, especially one of the things that you learn, I think, early on is, especially if they're up front, because when they're up front, no one else can hear them but you.
Mm-hmm.
So now you really look like a lunatic if you go at them too quick. So you really have to ignore those people long enough. You just have to let them be enough of a distraction to where there's really no pressure on you at all, other than to just tell them to shut up in some way.
So I have a couple of tricks. One is, you'll notice a lot of my heckler videos start with me saying, "What'd you just say?" Because I want to make sure I heard it correctly.
Yes.
And I want to give myself a chance to think.
Mm-hmm.
You'll also notice that I almost always repeat what they said so that the rest of the crowd can hear it too. And I don't start with them. Usually the first time someone says something, especially if it's something that, like, I don't really know what it is, I will have a line, something to the effect of, I don't know what you said, but I'm sure it was stupid. And then I just move on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's like a quick little, like, hey, I acknowledge you. don't do this again. And then if they do it again, there was a warning.
Right.
And so like, those are all just, you know, tricks I've kind of figured out over the years. And a lot of it is, you know, what a lot of people don't understand about crowd work and about heckler response is it's formulaic. If you know where you're leading someone, you know where the finish line is.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though, you know, it's game theory in that way, you let them choose their own adventure, but you have a solution for whichever way they go.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's, I think that's a lot of it.
Makes sense. Well,
it's, it's too late. he just fucked me up. I had a thought. So the main thing that or one of the things you brought up, which is also very true, is it's listening. Like I've told like younger comics over the years, or guys that I had on the road with me or whatever, where if you listen to what they're saying, because a lot of the time they're not really heckling. Like, to me, heckling is telling you suck. Like, that's what heckling is to me. Like, people just spouting shit out that think they're helping. They mean well. They're just dumb. So there's two different, you know what I mean?
I disagree. There are different types of heckling.
Yeah.
But interrupting.
Yes, interrupting.
Interrupting to get attention on yourself, that is heckling. And so even, I mean, I've been heckled by, you know, someone who's cheering too much.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who just after every joke, woo!
Right.
Eventually, you just have to enough. Be like, come on.
Right.
This
right.
isn't like that. What a weird, like, imagine doing that at a Broadway play.
Like, right.
What a dick. And so, like, I do think that in fact, the you suck heckling is probably the rarest form of it.
Honestly, yeah, totally. Absolutely. And, but the listening part is where, I think you really start to hone in, because once you trust yourself that you have the tools, like once you're comfortable enough on stage, I always call them like Slumdog Millionaire moments. Mm-hmm. Like, do you remember that? Did you see that movie?
Yeah.
So like, there's that moment where they're on that, they flash back to like a pile of garbage where there was a magazine cover, and that ends up being the answer to a question, right? So like, it's that same thing. I remember being in Texas and some guy talking about his trailer. And all I remembered was my parents watching Dallas and Who Shot JR back in the day. And I just instantly was like, what are you, the JR Ewing of the trailer park? and it just went, you know, the place goes nuts and they think I'm a genius. But all it was that one stupid connection that my brain could make out of all of them, just made that one in that moment. Because I listened to what that guy said.
Yeah. And, you know, that also shows that your audience was not a young audience at that show.
No, otherwise, no, it was not.
Very confused. They were not, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was like definitely, and this was also probably 10 or 15 years ago, but even then.
Still does not excuse it, though. That is a very old reference. Yeah. But it is, you know, listening.
It's knowing where you're at.
Yeah, it is really important. And also understanding that sometimes the universe just hands you one.
Yeah.
Like, totally. You know, every now and then it does, you know, you're talking about Slumdog Millionaire moments, and mm-hmm. it is, you know, sometimes they'll just hand you a subject you happen to know about. And I always find it funny when comedians try crowd work without a plan. Mm-hmm. And they'll be like, where are you from? Oh, Chicago. And they're like, cool. Like, you do not ask where someone's from unless you have a lot of regional knowledge mm-hmm. that you can then tie in to where they might say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, you've got to have a direction. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
What do you do for a living? You know, like, mm-hmm. I hope, you know, then it becomes an interview. And then,
yeah, exactly.
And then like,
where do you see yourself in 5 years?
Yeah. Like, just... But if you're going to do that, you better fucking be good at it.
Like, yeah.
You know, I mean, because you are, and even any amount of crowd work, you know, if you're really leaning on crowd work, you are definitely taking a chance of having a bad show. If you're going to spend most of your time in the crowd, you are taking a huge risk.
Yeah. I end every show I do with a Q&A. Yeah. And, you know, and I'll have the other comics who are on the show come up and do it with me. And mm-hmm. it is a thing where like 9 times out of 10, so fun. And yeah. part of the show that people really remember because it's unique and interesting and on the fly. And, but every now and then we're just like, well, that was anticlimactic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it just yeah. happens sometimes. And especially because, you know, when it's Q&A, you're really relying on them being interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. then half the questions are, I mean, I had one where someone was like, where are you from? Oh, this is going to lead to a good one. I'm like, this yeah. is why I don't say that to the audience.
Right. Because, like,
yeah. I'm like, because that guy definitely doesn't have a plan for when I say Queens.
Right. Now, okay, now what?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's take a break, get a word from our sponsors. We're going to catch up on some of these comments. Bill, you seem to be getting roasted in the comments. So, you know, that rarely happens. So
is it all Tim?
No, but somebody else came to your defense. So,
oh,
no,
nice.
I've gotten in there too, Bill. I really apologize.
So let's take a word from our sponsors. We'll come back and we'll continue with Steve.
Why take the best corn in the world and make it into fuel when you could make it into whiskey? That's the question that launched Revelton, Iowa's most visible and fastest growing distillery. Owners Rob and Christy Taylor embrace the grain-to-glass philosophy, sourcing ingredients locally and overseeing on-premises production and bottling at their facility in Osceola. One sip, and you'll agree that Revelton's handcrafted whiskeys, gins, and vodkas are the best you've ever tasted. And with the launch of their rye whiskey, made with 100% Iowa-grown rye and corn, and their new bourbon coming soon, there's more Revelton to love than ever. Iowa's own Revelton Distillery. ReveltonDistillery.com. The great thing about working from home is working from home. The worst thing is working from home, especially for face-to-face collaborations with customers and coworkers. And let's face it, coffee shop meetings are neither private nor professional. So skip the trip to Starbs and investigate Gravitate Co-working Space. For more than 10 years, Gravitate has provided large and small office and conference spaces perfect for hosting meetings, workshops, or other events, as well as private phone booths for confidential conversations. Plus, all spaces include secure fiber internet, free coffee, and access to a kitchenette. All you need is your laptop. Gravitate does the rest. And renting space at Gravitate is surprisingly affordable. An hour of office space costs about the same as venti caramel macchiatos and breakfast sandwiches for two. Daily and monthly rates are also available with no long-term commitment. Learn more at GravitateCoworking.com. That's GravitateCoworking.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with Steve. Yeah, Bill, Tim's roasting you in here. And then somebody said, Tim, can you say three nice things about Bill? And he said, Bill would make a great extra in a Kevin Smith movie. Bill's heroically vulnerable, and Bill books good guests. And then he said that was pretty exhausting.
Yeah, it didn't take way too long.
But Tim does ask a question. Who are your favorite comics to work with, Steve? Other than Bill.
Yeah, I mean, that's there are two ways to answer that question. I mean, one, in terms of like, you know, idols that I've gotten to work with have been incredible.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, the folks that I work with, you know, on the day-to-day touring, you know, I'm really lucky to be able to work with some very close friends and people I really respect and admire. The folks that I've been touring with the most lately are Brett Druck, Jarrett Berenstein, Kelly Collette, Andrew Rivers, and then when I'm in Australia, and also we toured in Europe together, Dan Muggleton. And Dan and I host a digital show together that we started during the pandemic, and we've been hosting it the entire time. And it is so fun. He's actually, the whole premise of that show is crowd work. It's all participation. And, you know, a lot of the audience has kind of become regular characters on the show, and it's almost like a difficult show for people to pick up because it's just like, oh yeah, we're in season four. You have no
idea. Yeah. No idea what's going on.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, you've got, there's something to be said. I remember early on trying to get that work, you know, as a feature act and, you know, you run into a lot of comics are bringing their own guy and, mm-hmm. and you know that you're better than that guy that they're bringing, and you get salty about it and this and that. And then years go by and you realize that the opener means nothing. Like, I mean, they mean something, well, but like, what I'm trying to say is you realize it's more important. Like when you have the power to bring your own opener, you're going to bring someone that you like to hang out with most of the day over the guy that's for sure going to get a sitcom next year, you know, or whatever.
I try to do both if I can.
Absolutely.
You know, one, the thing I never get is the headliners who bring someone who's garbage so that they can look better in comparison. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but everyone who bought tickets to this show needs to have a good night.
Right.
And part of that good night is enjoying the openers. In fact, I go up first on my shows.
Mm-hmm.
I go up first, do about 3 to 5 minutes of welcoming, and then I introduce the first support act.
Yep.
And the reason I do that is because that way they're not starting from scratch.
Cold, yeah.
They're getting vouched for. And it's, you know, some people have told me, be like, oh, that's a cool thing to do. I'm like, no, it's selfish. Because if I can bury my ego for those first 3 to 5 minutes, then they have a better show. When they have a better show, I don't come up cold, and then I have a better show.
Mm-hmm.
And so really I'm just warming up for me. It is a selfish thing to do, but it also helps them as well. But the comics that I really like touring with, I like touring with because they're killers. Mm-hmm. You know, they're people who they're going to push me to be a better comic. They're going to, you know, and they're also fun to hang out with. I mean, I've known, you know, I've known, especially like, you know, Andrew, I've known for a decade, you know, Brett, I've been touring with for like 7 years now. And so like, I know them really well and they are a good hang, but also when they're not opening for me, they're headlining.
Right.
And that's really important to me. I do not want the show to be like eking by. But one of the things that I'm going to really make an effort for this year that I realized I've gotten too far away from, and you know, my fiance is the one who reminded me of this, is that like, I love giving up and coming comics a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to try to do a guest set in every city because I don't know the next generation of comics now.
Right. Right.
You know, for a very long time, if someone ever got paid by a club, I knew their name.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have no idea who's next.
Yeah. You're too busy.
Well, I got insulated. I was traveling with my own crew. And so I didn't have a chance to see, you know, the next big thing in Charlotte or the next big thing in Milwaukee.
Right.
I don't know. And so what I'm going to start doing now is for next year, I'm going to be reaching out to, you know, to the local clubs and being like, who do you have? I want to see them.
Well, and it's rare too, though. You're also rare that you're bringing people that are going to push you. Like there's a difference between bringing people that are going to push you and bringing people that are going to give you notes, you know?
Like, yeah.
There's a lot of guys they'll go on the road with somebody for a year just because they watch their set all the time and give them tags, you know?
Yeah.
Like, but, but that's kind of, it's a rare thing. Like I've had a couple of comics that took me with them at different times in my career and said that was why, because they knew I'd make them work. And I always took that as a huge compliment, obviously, but at the same time, most of your work, and when you're in my position, you live in Des Moines, Iowa, and you're basically a career opener. Most of your work is going to come from headliners saying, hey, I want to take you with me. And if you're better than a certain level, most of them shy away from that, you know, unless they really like to party with you or something.
Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, I think a lot of it is, you know, is the person collaborative or not? You know, mm-hmm. I've got friends who have opened for some really big comics and they barely know that comic at all.
Right.
Because that comic does not hang out with them. They do not talk to them. They do not, you know, like I don't party, but every morning I'm usually up first because, you know, I'm an adult.
Right. And
some of the people I tour with iffy, but I will text the group and be like, hey, headed to breakfast. Anybody want to come down?
Yeah.
And you know, like that's something that I value.
Right.
I think it's important. And also I mean, some of them are people that, you know, we love writing with each other.
Right.
It's something where, like, if we do watch a set, we think of a tag, or, you know, every now and then, like, I'll just, you know, I'll sit down with one of them and just be like, hey, I am stuck on this bit. I like what I'm saying in it, but I feel like there's
it room needs for something. Yeah.
More
right.
Tags and where can we go with it? And, you know, I mean, just the other day with Brett, you know, my next, the hour that I'm working on now is going to be predominantly about mental health. And so, you know, we sat down and workshopped a bunch of stuff about anxiety and about, you know, that journey that I'm currently on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it was great. Really, really helpful stuff.
Let me ask you this. I'll ask you guys both this question, because you're talking about mentoring people, Steve. Mm-hmm. So who was, and I'll ask you too, Bill, who was more of a mentor for you coming up? And then who was a role model? Not necessarily an idol, but a role model of somebody you learned from.
No one. No, I'm kidding.
I'm the first Steve.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, there have been a lot over the years in, you know, in different ways. I think that, you know, someone who meant a lot to me early on was Jimmy Brogan. Jimmy Brogan, you know, wrote for and booked the Tonight Show for years, and he knows what he's doing. And, you know, he was someone who, you know, I could always call him and have a question for him. And then someone in more recent years, Elaine Boozler. Elaine is someone who, like, it was such a crazy thing the way this worked out. This is like, this is the universe handing you one, where I had always found her very funny. I knew her stuff from, you know, from when I was a kid. And I found out she was at the Laugh Factory for the late show when I was on the early show, because she was back doing the Tonight Show for the first time in like decades. And so she was running her set. So I decide, hey, I'm going to stick around. I've heard she's a nice person. I'm going to stick around and see if I can say hello and introduce myself. And she happens to, you know, she's doing the set. The crowd's a little weird. She ends up going off script and randomly references Curtis Granderson. This is when he was on the Mets. And I'm a huge Mets fan. And so I was like, oh, great. I have an in. And so I go over to her after the show and, you know, I tell her, I like, I love your work. And, you know, I didn't really expect to see a Curtis Granderson reference. She goes, oh, I'm a huge Mets fan. I'm like, oh my God. And so then we start talking about that. And then I find out she does this, like, she runs this huge animal rescue charity, and I'm a big dog rescue person. And we talk about that. And then in this incredible moment, you know, we're having a really lovely conversation, and she asks me, you know, like how the business is and et cetera. And at that point I was hosting Laughs, and I told her that, and she goes, oh yeah, I know. And I was like, you know? And she goes, yeah, I record it every week. And I was like, no one watches that show. I have never had anyone come up to me and say, oh, I know you from that. And she goes, oh, I watch it. She's like, no offense to you. She's like, I watch it because you guys break new comics and I want to see who's out there. And, you know, from that, we just kind of bonded, and she almost, you know, she practically adopted me. Like, she was, you know, inviting me over for dinner all the time and introduced me to other comics. And like, her husband is lovely. Like, it's just really been incredible. And we're still close friends. And now she's on the board of directors of my foundation. And like, she's just been really wonderful to me.
Yeah. And that's something that we should touch on too, is everything that you've built out there. And the fact that you live in Pennsylvania now blows my fucking mind. But
well, I just wanted to do a little bit of black and gold for you, Bill.
Yeah. I appreciate it. It's very nice of you. You should, but go ahead and kind of expand on that a little bit. We can get to mine, but while we're on the subject,
I'll just, you know, just real quick, because I know we don't have a ton of time, but the Steel City Arts Foundation is a live, work, play environment mainly for stand-up comedians. We have grantees that receive free housing. There's a podcast studio and a green screen studio and a live stream studio and a gym and all kinds of equipment and mentorship that, you know, our members can use. It's all paid for by the foundation. There's no membership fee or anything, but you know, for the folks in Pittsburgh, they can apply right on the website. For the folks who want to come to Pittsburgh for the housing, they can apply on the website as well. It's steelcityaf.com. And that's the long and short of it.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's amazing. I don't know any other comic that's reached down as much as you have.
I appreciate it, but it's because I have a philosophy that the worst thing about comedy is that it's lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be very selfish. There are a lot of comedians who think that this is a zero sum game, and it is not. Someone else getting a booking does not mean you don't. It means you don't get that booking, but it also means the people who see that comic, if they're a good comic, the people who see that
another
comic
one
might. Exactly. Mm. The only competition you have is bad comics. Because if someone goes and sees a bad comic, then they're like, oh, this art form sucks. So those guys. Yeah. But for the good comics, you know, I absolutely root for them. And, you know, it's a solo art, but it should be a team sport.
Agreed. It's too bad. I mean, it'd be probably too tough and a little too exclusive. We'd end up with a lot of gatekeepers, but it's too bad we can't find a way to unionize nationally, you know, the way New York kind of did, which I think, I don't know if that's even really much of a thing anymore. I know Ted Alexandro was instrumental in that, but
it isn't. I was involved in that effort as well. I was pretty new at the time, but I was pretty vocal about it. I think the biggest thing is that there's never going to be a comedians union until there can be a bookers union, because you need collective bargaining happens. It has to happen on both sides. And while yes, do bookers fuck comedians over? Absolutely. How many comedians no show? How many comedians show up drunk? How many comedians fight at a club? How many comedians, you know, hit on the wait staff while they're on stage, which is absolutely sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. Like, how many comedians just are monsters? And so until the bookers are protected, the comedians can't be either. Like, we have to work on both.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, because for comics, it's always been basically like just 100% about money and increases, you know, but for the bookers, it's like, well, I have to protect myself from that whole list that you just gave. And then
it's about, you know, liability.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think comics look at things that way. And also, you know, there's those different moments where, you know, over the years you got fucked by a booker, but what does fucked actually mean? Like, did you agree to get paid $400 for this gig and you went and did it and you got your $400, but then you found out the booker made $1,000 and you're pissed off the booker made more than you? Yeah, but you agreed to do it for $400. So
yeah,
there's some liability on both sides there, you know?
Yeah, I've been in this situation where, like, a booker lied to me about how much the gig pays.
Right.
And that sucks. Mm-hmm. It's also unethical for the booker to take that much.
Right.
However, that doesn't mean he screwed you over. That means he's unethical.
Right.
And you have the choice to not work for them again.
100%.
And, you know, there are a lot of shitty things that bookers do. Absolutely. This is a profession of broken toys.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's a lot of shitty things that we do too. And, you know, and they have to go hand in hand. We need to take accountability for our own actions as well.
Yeah. Agreed. I guess as far as, for me, any mentorship, it's such a wide variety. Like, it feels like nobody in particular ever just like takes you under their wing, so to speak. You just end up learning from so many different people for so many different reasons. But like, I would say those guys that, like, for me, you know, we've got Willie Farrell here locally, who to us is like the godfather of comedy.
He's, no kidding.
You know, he's the guy when you see somebody go on stage and try to do crowd work, like, I feel like I've come up watching the master. Like,
yeah,
the guy goes on stage and does 30 minutes a night he could never repeat ever again and crushes 99.9% of the time. And, you know, he's been around when I was 21 starting out in comedy, he'd been at it for 20 years already. And so now it's like, he always took a liking to me. And I think it's because in Des Moines, there was about 20 years between the two of us. Like, as far as being born and raised here and pursuing comedy and actually doing it for a living, I think between him and me, there was nobody. It was just kind of a bunch of posers or just guys that kind of dipped their toe for a while.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, Willie's always kind of looked at me almost like a son, you know, more like a little brother. But and then, you know, John Bush, who was, you know, he was in the New York scene for a long time and then, you know, ended up on a off Broadway. He's been a guest on here and ended up in Des Moines. And it's just these people, when you look up to them and you find out that they respect what you do, like when people you respect what you're doing, that's the biggest victory that you can possibly get in this business. And in my opinion, like,
yeah,
that's the good stuff right there. The,
yeah,
fame and fortune sometimes is a lot of luck. I mean, there's a lot of hard work involved, and most guys that end up rich and famous in this business earned it. There's very few that didn't earn it in some way, shape, or form. It doesn't just get handed over. But the cream tends to rise to the top, you know, fads happen, but it's that wholesomeness that you started out with, just getting that respect from somebody you look up to. That's, it's never going to get better. I don't think nothing can replace it.
Yeah. Agreed.
Ross wants to know, he says he's late to the party, but what is Steve's political standing on sports officials versus Bills?
What the fuck does refs have to do with politics?
I'm not sure I know what that means. And I don't know if you mean Bill, who's hosting the show, or the Bills.
Yeah. No, they mean me, because I hate referees on just as a species.
I am such a proponent of robot umpires.
Thank you. See, there's a strike zone. There's rules. You don't get to have your own strike zone. It's the strike zone.
And you don't get to have your own strike zone on Tuesday and then have a different one on Friday.
Yes.
Like, it is so preposterous that we can't just standardize that, because even the best umpires are accurate 98% of the time.
Yeah, they're still human. If you can't remove the human element from officiating, then it's not really officiating, is it?
Yeah, you don't want to remove the human element from the game, but right. You do want to remove the human element from the rules.
Yes, from the judgment of the game.
Suspect. Yes, right.
Yeah, the rules, like, should be rules.
That's another one of my favorite things. Listen, it's a judgment call. No, there's no such thing. There's rules. It's right or wrong.
Yeah, and Angel Hernandez is wrong.
Yes, 100%.
95% of the time.
That was the first name I was thinking of, too. But then you had Pat Hoberg, who called a perfect game this past season. But he's actually from Iowa. He's good friends with my little brother.
But also, like, when you look at it and you go, okay, if I were missing as often as Angel Hernandez was, I wouldn't be hireable.
No.
No.
Like, if 10% of my shows were awful, I couldn't book shows.
No.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, officials, like lawyers and weathermen and officials, I'm pretty sure those are the three that can still get paid sucking at their job. Like, they can completely and totally expect a paycheck even though they're bad.
Well, and centers on some basketball teams. But that said, I do have to jump in a minute.
Yeah, no problem.
Go ahead. Before I do, though, I do want to thank Bill for one of my favorite comedy memories. And I don't know if you remember this.
I'm ready.
I was passing through Des Moines, and we had a night off, and it was the night of the open mic at the Funny Bone.
Oh, and God, yes. Shirley and Josh, you hadn't seen
Shirley? Yes. And so I didn't know what Shirley and Josh was. And do your listeners know?
They have no idea. This is going to be great, because I have a story to pile on.
So Shirley and Josh, Shirley was a ventriloquist. And by ventriloquist, I mean someone who had a puppet. Her mouth moved more than his did. And she was really playing into that. You know, in like late 80s sitcoms, they started doing the thing of like, oh, it's the grandmother with the foul mouth. Yeah. It was basically everybody was trying to be who's the boss. Mm-hmm. Well, that was what she was trying to do, but she couldn't really do it. And I didn't really know any of this. And Bill, you son of a bitch, you not only did not tell me about this, but you made sure that I went on directly after her. And so I'm watching this absolute cult favorite train wreck. It was one of these things that like every local comic and audience member who was there was thrilled because they were like, yes, this is going to be the worst 5 minutes of the evening. It's going to be incredible. And you had me go up right after her. And I just, first 20 seconds of my set, I just didn't say anything. I was just like, just in
where
disbelief.
Do you begin?
And finally, I remember this day so well. I finally just opened my set by saying, I grew up in New York City and I used to take the train to high school every day. And I've seen New York City subway shit. And I've never seen anything like that. So I'm sure, I mean, this was like 15, 20 years ago. Shirley, I'm guessing, has passed on since then.
Yes.
She was 1,000 years old at the time. I can't imagine.
She was a person that, you know, back then especially, the open mics people came out of the woodwork, especially if it was the club. If a Funny Bone, the weird thing about the Funny Bone as a club is people actually think they can fill out an application to be the MC or something like that. Like they actually think that this is a job you can apply for. And so every nutbag comes in and does this open mic. There'd be 20 people. Well, Paul, the owner at the time, he would give there'd be 25 people. Everybody gets 3 minutes. And if you ran the light, you got your mic shut off. Like that was it. Well, Shirley got to go as long as she wanted. It didn't matter if it was 20 minutes. Paul fucking loved her. And she was, I mean, it was one of those things. Like there's an old bit about that Patton Oswalt does about going to the open mic. Like it was one of those things that if they did it on purpose, it was genius. But yeah, because they didn't, there was like some problems, some issues or something.
Yes.
But and she was, like you said, she was like 100 years old, very frail, but the nicest lady, so fucking nice. Just the sweetest woman. Paul, like, I remember Paul gave her some, bought like plane tickets for her son to come and see her, did some, never told anybody, did shit like that all the time.
Yeah.
But anyway, my best friend got married, I don't know, a few years after that. And Shirley ended her set with, she would get a feather boa and they would play that Short Dick Man song. And she,
I remember that. Oh my God. I think I blocked that part out until just now.
She'd walk around and go, don't want no Short Dick Man. And she'd have the feather boa and do all the, and so I hired her for my best friend's bachelor party. And my best friend at the time, like the bachelor party started, it was a Saturday and Iowa played Purdue at 11 o'clock in the morning. So the bachelor party started at 11 for the Iowa game. So we're hammered by 3 o'clock. Everybody's all fucked up to the point where like guys are doing coke just to make it through the night. Like it was a crazy ass party. So everybody's just insanely. So we get him into the kitchen and I brought my whole sound system. Basically what I told her was just to come in and do her Short Dick Man song. I was like, just do that. I paid her $100 and I told her she would make all kinds of money. So she comes in and we have him blindfolded. And sit, and we tell him he's got to sit on his hands on the chair, and we blindfold him and start playing the music, you know. And then she comes walking in, and everybody's cheering, you know, like the strippers in there just about. And don't want no short dick. And then we ripped the blindfold off in this her, and he just looked at me. He's like, you motherfucker. And he got us back at the end, because at the end she leaned over to give him a kiss and he just grabbed her fucking head and started French kissing the shit out of her.
Like, do you realize, Bill, that you very well may be the only person to have ever given her a professional comedy gig?
Oh, I guarantee fucking it. And she walked out of there for like $500.
Yeah.
Because people were just throwing 20s at her, and it was the most hysterical shit. We had it on tape. I don't know what happened to it. I wish I could find it.
Yeah.
Because he just looks right at the camera, just, you motherfucker.
Steve, we really appreciate you coming on. Ross even said, best favorite guest they've seen on a local podcast outside of Dan McCarney. So
nice. I don't know who that is, but I'm going to have him killed. Because I cannot accept being number two.
He's probably the most beloved coach in the state of Iowa from both fan bases. I mean, he's a guy that's
loved by both
fan bases. But that's all right.
Steve, you.
Where can people find you online and things like that, so they know where to find you?
At Steve Hofstetter on all social media, except for Twitter. That place is a fucking rotting cesspool. But you can also check out Steel City AF at Steel City AF on everything. And opening a new entertainment venue in Pittsburgh in the next couple of weeks called Sunken Bus. So check it out at Sunken Bus. And that's everything. Awesome. And also, shout out to my fiance has been stirring trouble in the comments. And
Yes, she has. She's your biggest fan. She's your most annoying fan. And she perfectly said, I'm going to take credit for that too.
She's the absolute best.
So
just remember Wade. I'm going to think of a name. And again, cutest way to deal with anxiety I've ever heard.
Hell yeah. Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Savannah's hey, mad.
Oh yeah. Also. Yeah. That is a good point. We have a podcast too. Apologies, Savannah. It's called Judgy Two Shoes. And it's the two of us just judging stories from the internet and from our viewers. They submit stuff and we tell them why they're wrong. Awesome. It's fun.
Oh, that's great, man. Hey, much love, Steve. It's been a long time. I'm sorry I didn't get out when you were in town, but we'll see each other again soon. You know the good ones always do.
Hell yeah. I'll be back next year. Come do a set.
Hell yeah, brother. See you soon.
It's been a pleasure. All right. Steve, thank you so much, and we'll keep in touch.
Take care. Thank you.
So bye-bye. For everybody, this has been False Starts with Bill Blank and Chris Shipley. Check out all the rest of Three Beards Media podcasts on the network. Bill, got any closing words?
I got nothing, man. It's just it's always refreshing that to be able to dip into the list of personalities I've gotten to know over the years. And I guess I'm blessed to have lived this life up to this point, that I can get like guys like Steve to come on here and give a little bit of themselves to our audience. And again, it's just this is a very important podcast for me, and it's good for people to get on here and get vulnerable, and you know, just keep pursuing that mental health. Everybody, go to therapy, do what you got to do, eat some shrooms.
That's right. Everybody have a you know, and holidays coming up, people struggle a little bit there, so on.
Absolutely.
So I guess we'll end it with, you know, make sure you're reaching out, reach out to whoever you can. And if you can't find anybody, you reach out to us. So
we're there, baby. Happy holidays, everybody.
All right. You guys, everybody have a great, great night. And thanks for listening.